You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Well, Lizzie, as usual, I'm in my shed. Where on earth are you?
Well, finally, Tom, I'm not at home. This time I am up in Switzerland. I'm in the Swiss Alps and I'm up in our training base in Andermatt. And we've been here for about a week and we're just about to head to the Giro in central and southern Italy, which is pretty exciting.
It's a busy season. You must be on the road for a long time. Between now and the end of the season, do you ever get a chance to come home?
So actually, I've not been away for that long, really. I think I came away a couple of weeks ago, came over for the European Championships, Plouay World Tour Road Race, European Road Race, La Course, did my own little Tour de France, and then we stayed with the team until the Giro. And then from now, it is going to be pretty hectic, kind of pending selection. There's the World Championships, and then straight after that, it goes into the Spring Classics, but in the autumn. And then it's just kind of, yeah, the races are back to back really until we finish the season. So yeah, I'm not going to be going home for a while, but it's nice. It's nice to chill out with the team and we've got a really great training base up here. So yeah, it's been not too bad. I miss my cats, of course, but it's been quite nice.
Well, Lizzie, I'm glad you mentioned some of the races you've been doing, because the last time I really saw you was during this one.
All right now. For all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, I've been asked to relay a request from the Gramercy Riffs. It's a special for the Warriors. That's that real live bunch from Coney. And I do mean the Warriors. Here's a hit with them in mind.
So that was, for those who recognise it, the theme from the Warriors. Bit of a weird segue here, but if you've seen The Warriors, you'll remember that there was a badass 1970s street gang in that film called the Lizzies, and I could not help but think of that when I saw you and Lizzie Deignan out at the front at Plouay. A big day.
That is brilliant. I did not make that association at all. That's brilliant. Yeah, so my second race of my own mini Tour de France was the World Tour race in Plouay, and we had a pretty good day. My teammate, Marlen Reuser, Swiss champion, she'd attacked. And as she came back, there was kind of attacks and counters going. And then at the moment that the peloton was really tired, I made an attack and got a gap. Then Lizzie Deignan and Jip van den Bos from Bols Dolmans bridged over to me. And then very soon after, Jip crashed into a bush. So it was just Lizzie and I. And then it was an hour-long breakaway. And unfortunately, she beat me in the sprint. But, you know, Lizzie, I'm going to get you next time. But it was pretty cool to have, you know, two British Lizzies off the front. And it's a shame it wasn't the European Championships, because that was 2 days later and neither of us had such good luck. I crashed out in the first 20 kilometres and, you know, gashed open my hip and my arm and my knee. And then Lizzie crashed out halfway through the race and thankfully was okay, but kind of went into a ditch and it was a bit of a scary crash. But yeah, she was okay and then came back and she won La Course. Of course, 2 days after that. So it's been a really busy week and quite a successful week for the two Lizzies and definitely a successful week for my team. And it was nice to kind of continue our successful run with my teammate Leia getting on the podium in Strada as well. So next up is the Giro and we've got a lot to live up to because we won a stage there last year. So we've got a strong team and we're really, really looking forward to it. But that's my news, Tom. What we want to know is, did the baby arrive?
Yeah, I'm now the proud owner. Is that the right word? Owner? I've added a baby daughter to the mix. Today's my first sort of proper day back at work, really, if you can call what I do work. Bit of a whirlwind. Having a baby during a pandemic and a lockdown is a real trip. Not the most advisable course of action, I'd say, but, you know, you can't plan for these things. But everyone is home, everyone is healthy, and I have even been able to now that I can actually be further than, like, 20 minutes from my house and I'm not having to shield my wife so much, I've actually been out on my bike, which is amazing.
That's good news.
It's great, yeah. And, I mean, thanks to, actually, I've got to say, because I've been off the bike for a while, so my bikes were in a bit of a state of, disrepair. And getting into a bike shop at the moment, obviously, with it being the summer and with there being such a run on bikes, it's really hard. So thanks to Duncan from Faction Bikes, who actually came and picked my bike up, took it away, fixed it and brought it back. That's the future for me. That's it. Just have someone take your bike away and sort it out.
You're lucky you even got it sorted out, Tom, because what with COVID, even if you can find a bike shop to get your bike into, who knows if they're even going to have the components. So at the moment, it's a crazy situation. You know, there's such a shortage of components because the supply chain just completely stopped during COVID. And what with the crazy increase in bike sales across the world, every man and their dog wanted a bike. You simply can't get components at the moment. And we had this situation where my team went to race a race in Bologna in Italy, and we had 7 of our bikes stolen from the truck. And that's really shit. And of course we have spare components in the service course, but replacing that many, you know, you don't expect that many to suddenly disappear all at once. You know, you have a left shifter, a right shifter, a few chains, whatever. And we're sponsored by Rotiv with our cranks and Ceramic Speed with our OSPWs and our bearings and stuff. But we actually buy the rest of our components in so that we can use these specific components with them. And then we buy the Shimano components. And my team was struggling to get anything. You know, they phoned Shimano Europe had nothing, and I know that it's the same in the UK with Madison had nothing, and it's really difficult, and I don't know when the supply chain is going to kind of get itself back to normal.
Well, it's interesting you said there's a couple of things there I want to pick up on. Actually, you're right, I'm on my Cannondale. I've got a Super 6 Evo, and there's a part, it's the part, I don't know what I should call it, but it connects the front derailleur to the frame, and there's like a little sort of part that goes between the two.
The front neck
and
hanger. Let's
that's
call
corroded.
It front neck hanger.
Let's call it a front neck hanger for what it's worth. That part is corroded, can't get a new one until December. December.
Yeah.
And that's from a pretty big, you know, it's from a very big brand. But you mentioned there about your bikes being stolen. I was fascinated by that for the reason, like, if you steal, I mean, you ride Chapter 2 bikes, and no one else, you don't see many Chapter 2 bikes. I presume these bikes have been stolen to then sell on. Like, how on earth do you sell such a standout bike? It's like, you know, as soon as someone sees it, they'll know that it's hot, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much experience with bike thieving in my career. so I'm not really sure how you sell them on. But I thought the same, you know. Trek Segafredo women had their bikes stolen the night before Strade Bianche, and they were fortunate enough to still be able to ride. 5 of them were on their spare bikes, and Ellen van Dijk actually was using Coen de Kort's bike from the men's side, I think. And so, oh, yeah. You know, the fact that they had both teams there enabled them to all have a bike, and that they had spare bikes. But I don't know. It's a rubbish situation, and I don't know how the thieves get out of it. Maybe they just rub down the frames. But even then, the frames from our Chapter 2 bikes, they're quite specialised, really. They're quite different to anything else you see. So I don't know. I'm hoping that we'll get them back. And I know, actually, again, Ellen van Dijk had her bike stolen last year in a race in Germany. And it was a targeted theft because there was a hotel where all the riders were staying, and there was a room full of bikes. And her bike was stolen, but other bikes were moved out of the way in order to steal her bike. And then a number of months later, she got a call from the German police saying that her bike had been recovered. So it does happen that they're found, and of course, we hope they're found again, but, you know, at the moment, you know, of course, all the riders' bikes have been replaced, but it was a pretty horrible time for the team. And, you know, coming up to a really busy week of racing with European Championships and Plouay and La Course as well. So it was a stressful week for the team, but thankfully we're back on our feet now, and we've found our chains and our shifters, and we're good to race the Giro.
I thought this would be an appropriate bit of music for this section. I've always fancied, you know, being a sort of prohibition era private detective hunting for clues, and that's what I'm doing at the moment. I spent a little bit of the last sort of 6 months mostly at home tracking down interesting cycling artifacts on sites like eBay, and I'm in the hunt for one, and I might need your help. I recently started rewatching the late 90s, early 2000s sitcom Spaced.
Brian, did you notice that everything that transpired in those three films, and I mean everything, can be attributed to the actions of one very minor character?
Who?
The gunner on the Star Destroyer at the beginning of the first film.
How come?
Well, because if the gunner had shot the pod that C-3PO and R2 were in, they wouldn't have got to Tatooine, they wouldn't have met Luke, Luke wouldn't have met Ben, they wouldn't have met Han and Chewie, they wouldn't have rescued Princess Leia. None of it would have happened.
Chaos theory.
Daisy, played by Jessica Hines, certainly in the first season, in most of the episodes, she's wearing a hoodie, and it's an Adidas hoodie that says Criterium du Dauphiné on it. And, well, basically, I want it. It's a beautiful piece. So far, I have emailed two people from the costume department for that show. No replies. I've Googled around. I've written to an Adidas historian. No reply. So if anyone can help me track it down in my best Philip Marlowe style, that would be greatly appreciated. Get in touch. I'm at Tom_Wally on Twitter. Even if you've just got an idea of how I might go about tracking it down, because I'm currently out of ideas. So yeah, help out an old sleuth, please.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
De pression, s'il vous plaît.
Grand.
Well, cheers, Rich. Cheers, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel, and thanks to Tom and Lizzie. And sorry to butt in the middle of another great episode of Service Course. We are at the Tour de France. Lizzie's off riding the Giro Rosa, and we've interrupted to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel.
Well, Rich, you've moved to France, getting to grips with the language. I think your French has really come on this year.
Do you mean that?
I do mean that, yeah. A lot more confident. But have you been supplementing actually living in France with using the Babbel app to kind of just firm up those bedrocks and those foundations to the language?
Yes, I have been using Babbel. They've been sponsoring the podcast for a couple of months now. And the sort of daily 15-minute sessions are short enough that you can quite easily fit them in, but long enough that you feel you can actually learn something every time. And I think, well, confidence is the key word, isn't it? And if you kind of build it into your daily routine, that definitely helps to build the confidence. And yeah, living here now, I will be relying on it more and more. I may even, you know, you can have longer lessons if you like, and if you've got more time. So I'll probably up the length of the lessons, I think, when we go back after the Tour de France.
It's very interactive, isn't it? It's almost like a game, really, and you feel the progress through the levels and you get to grips, and then it kind of reinforces things that you've maybe done in previous days and then takes you on to the next step. It feels like a very organic way to build the language as you go.
And it encourages you through the technology, the voice recognition technology, to pronounce things correctly. So it's not just knowing the theory or knowing the words, it's actually saying them properly. And that's one of the great things about it as well, I think.
It's like having the pronunciation police in your pocket, isn't it? You can learn
better than that.
You can learn 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian and German. And Babbel is available as an app or on a website, and your progress will be synced across all devices. So you could do some at home in your office and some on the move. If you want to give Babbel a try, they're offering all of our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6 month subscription if you use the promo code CYCLE. So go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code CYCLE when you sign up for a 6 month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play, promo code CYCLE. And is that the pronunciation police siren in the background?
I think it is, yeah.
All right then, Lizzie. Well, we had a bit of a waffle. We had a lot to catch up on there, didn't we, really? In this episode today, there's a couple of things we're going to look at. We're going to talk about saddles. I desperately need to talk about saddles because I spent so long on the indoor trainer during lockdown that I've developed some quite painful areas. Something about riding indoors without that movement, it's terrible for saddle sore. So we're going to talk about saddles. Also, though, we're going to talk about the Tour de France and some of the tech that's being ridden there currently. Lizzie, how much of the Tour have you been able to watch?
Well, I've been watching a lot of it because I've been up training for a week, but we're about to start the Giro, and it usually coincides with the Tour. your interest in the tour then kind of lessens and lessens. So we always try and watch, you know, the end of the stage, and I'll always catch up on the results and watch the highlights and things. But yeah, it's been a fun first week, and it's been really interesting to see the Tour de France tech, because I think in previous years, normally everybody would bring out their biggest tech for the Tour de France. And because this year, we didn't even know if the Tour de France would go ahead, really, until the day it started, let's be honest. We knew there were doubts surrounding it, you know, starting in the COVID hotspot of Nice. And so manufacturers didn't really have an option but to release their big new bikes early, perhaps. So we saw the Specialized SL7 go out really recently, but perhaps that would have been released at the Tour de France and then released to the public a bit later. And there are some things that have kind of been had a hidden release at the Tour de France this year. Canyon have released their new aero bike, and that's been seen there. And one good way to tell is that if you want to ride a bike in the Tour de France or in any UCI race, you have to have a UCI certificate for that bike, and it has to be on the UCI's list of certified frames. So at the beginning of the year, you can go and look at this list, and you can kind of work out which manufacturers are going to release new frames over the next year. So yeah, we've seen that new Canyon Aeroad now. It's pretty similar to the old Aeroad. It's a little elongated. What else have we seen? Christoph had those €5,000 diamond encrusted glasses that he was wearing on the podium. Although I have heard that there is only one pair of those, and they're going to be shared with the other sponsored teams if they get on the podium too, which is interesting.
I mean, it's funny really, because normally at Tour de France, like a lot of the magazines and the news sites and stuff will have people at the race, and they'll be around the mix zone, around the buses, you know, just looking and taking photos of the bikes. Obviously this year it's a little bit different, so we are still seeing articles of people saying, oh, spotted at the Tour de France, but for me a lot of that stuff is just coming directly from a press release. So a lot of the stuff I've had to spot when I've been watching, I've had to do it from afar, and obviously I'm watching everything on the GCN race pass as well, which means I'm watching it on my phone, so it's even harder to spot a lot of the new tech out there.
Yeah, some things are obvious. I noticed in the peloton actually that Koo had released their new glasses, which were obviously for the Tour de France, because I noticed them on Lizzie Deignan's face during La Course. And Oakley, of course, released their special Tokyo edition Corico frames, which is also interesting, because I wonder if there were other things that were going to be done for Tokyo that have been put off. Again, in 2016, Specialized released their torch frames, which were really cool because they changed colour with the heat in Rio. So perhaps we'll see some of these kind of special editions things that were going to be planned for this year moved back a year as well.
One thing I have spotted, and sort of it seems to be an increasing trend, is the integrated bar stem. Is this the death of the stem? Are we going to see no more stems anymore? Because a lot of the riders now seem to be riding those integrated handlebars.
I don't think so. And I haven't actually ridden an integrated bar and stem before, mostly because I like to ride narrow bars. And I think at the moment, you can't really get very narrow integrated bar and stem combos. I remember seeing some of the girls riding the Trex last year, and they were on these 42 or 44 width bars, and they were so wide. And I just thought, why don't you just ditch the integrated bar and stem? And I mean, you know, you save so many watts by using a 38 and a normal stem than an integrated one with a 44. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So, you know, we're women, we're narrower. We have narrower shoulders. We need narrower bars. It makes sense. So I don't know. I think that integrated bar and stems are a bit of a pain, and like it's not right for everybody. And if you want to change your length of your stem or your bike setup, then you've got to spend hundreds of pounds on a whole new system, and then you've got to reroute everything, and to be honest, it's a pain in the ass. So maybe for the pro peloton it's going to kind of phase out a little bit, but I don't think it's going to phase out for us lot, you know, for us mere mortals.
Well, it's interesting you said that, actually, because I did have a take a look yesterday at some, and you know, you are looking at the best part of £500 for a set.
That's a lot.
And you're right. You're right, actually. The smallest size I think I could find was maybe a 40. So what are you riding? Are you riding a 38 when you're riding?
I'm actually on a 40 at the moment, but I'm trying to go down to a 38. Right. But yeah, no, even when they say 40, actually you'll find they often measure up as 42. So you have to be a little bit careful with handlebar sizes, because you have to, it says one thing, and the best thing is to go to a bike shop and just take your tape measure with you, or take your shoulders and arms with you, and just look at it and feel it and see how it feels, because sometimes they measure the center to center, sometimes they measure it's a flared bar at the bottom and they measure the center of the bar at the bottom of the drops, sometimes they measure the kind of the middle bit, and so not all measuring is equal, I would say, and the best thing is to just go and have a look at it, or just like really really look into the geometry and the dimensions really really well, because it should tell you, but sometimes just from looking on a web page is not going to give you it's not going to tell the whole story, basically.
Another thing I want to talk about, and this is actually appropriate with you going into the Giro tomorrow, a lot of the teams have obviously come prepared with coloured chains, coloured bar tape. So where are you sourcing your pink chains from, Lizzie?
I don't know. I'll have to ask Ceramic Speed. I'm sure they've got something sorted out for us. I did actually think that's pretty crazy that it was Ceramic Speed who did it actually for De Koenig Quickstep. And I thought that was pretty cool that they had this green-tinted and yellow-tinted lube made up already. But I don't know if we've got any of that. Maybe it doesn't quite filter down to the women's teams. It's only the men's teams that get this kind of sick trick tag. But yeah, there we go. I don't know. Maybe our team management have something up their sleeve. But we'll see. We'll see if we get the pink jersey first, and then we'll see what trick bike tech we get.
Well, the last thing I wanted to pick up, I don't know what else you spotted, but well, one more thing is Sergio Higuita's Colombian national champions jersey, which is one of the most beautiful jerseys I've ever seen. Don't know if you spotted it. Absolutely stunning, I think.
Yeah, and in stark contrast to Primoz Roglic's jersey, which is a load of rubbish, in my opinion. You know, I've seen the Slovenian national champions jersey on the women's side, and I think it's great. And I think it's a real travesty that some teams don't honour the national champions jerseys the way they should be. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to name and shame here. And Sunweb is one of those teams. They never do a good job. I'm sorry, Sunweb, but you guys need to sort it out. I remember Liana Lippert's German national champions outfit was just, you know, you could barely even tell that it was a national champ suit. It had all the sponsors, it had everything on. And Corinne Rivera's jersey when she was American national champion, it could have been so great, but it just wasn't. And then you take that jersey and you put it onto Ruth Winder's shoulders, and Santini and Trek did an amazing job. So, you know, a national champions jersey is such a beautiful thing when it's done right, but it can really be mangled as well, and it's such a shame.
Well, before we finish this section, I was actually looking through sort of the tour-winning bikes from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and just sort of looking at the important changes, because sometimes it's difficult to really spot them from year to year. But interestingly, 2010, when Andy Schleck won the tour, obviously Contador was disqualified, that was the first victory for SRAM. That was 10 years ago, and now SRAM is everywhere. Do you know what was interesting about Lance Armstrong's bike in 2005, so 15 years ago?
I do not. That is before my time, I'm afraid.
Well, interestingly enough, that was the last bike, and I don't think it'll happen again, to have a downtube shifter.
Oh, wow.
Because Lance had a downtube shifter on his climbing bike. Yeah, and that's 15 years
and
ago.
What I would like to know is, was that across the whole peloton? Did everybody have downtube shifters at that point?
I think it was just Lance, and I think he just liked he had one downtube shifter for his front mech.
Interesting.
And this one, well, this is 2011, but 2011 was the first time that electronic shifters won the tour. And obviously now everybody uses them. That was 9 years ago, so.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks, as ever, to our longtime sponsors, Science in Sport, giving Lionel that descending power that he's showing throughout the tour so far. If you want to get 25% off your next order of Science in Sport products, then use the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. See, Francois? It's easy. All right, Lizzie, that was our second bit of waffle. Let's get on to... Well, you've been doing some interviews, haven't you? We've been talking to people about saddles.
I have indeed. So, saddles are something that is close to my heart and close to my bum, as with all of us. And I think it is a really, really important topic and something that isn't talked about enough. I think it's a really difficult issue because it's something people are concerned about to talk about because they're embarrassed or, you know, understandably, you know, it can be a personal area, and especially when things go wrong. But it is totally normal, and we all have problems. We all sit on saddles, and sitting on a bike can be pretty uncomfortable. So I think it's better we just talk about it and get these problems out in the open. So I had a chat with...
Lizzie, honestly, I've got no shame. I mean, there should be actually a content warning here, because I've got no shame in talking about some of the horrendous saddle sores that I've actually had. I mean, I've had some shockers. So be warned.
Is
I might bring
just,
that up.
Is
later
that just
on.
Recently with the turbo, or is that a long term thing?
In general, so let's just look.
Share.
If you're squeamish, turn off now. But I mean, I remember one that I had, and it had been so long term, and I eventually sort of intervened and squeezed, and I actually squeezed it so hard that I heard this sort of like tss, and I was like, oh, that sounds ominous. I went to the bathroom and I took my finger off it, and literally it shot 6 feet across the room, just blood, and made a sort of a line up the tiling in the bathroom. It was quite shocking.
Our director tells us this brilliant story, which actually I should really just get him to recount for this episode, about how he was in a tour and he had the leader of a race, and it was the night before, and it was the night before the next stage, obviously, and the rider said, I'm not starting tomorrow, I can't start tomorrow, and he didn't want to tell anybody why, and he just said, I'm not starting. So he went to the rider's room, sat down with the rider and the doctor, and was like, what is going on? And eventually the rider said, look, I've got this awful saddle sore. I can't sit. I just can't sit down. And he talks about this black cream that they had back in the day, and they put it on the saddle sore, and then they left it overnight. And then in the morning, him and the doctor came back in and squeezed this saddle sore. And just like you said, he describes it as exploding across the room. Anyway, what we want to avoid, this is most of the graphic details over, but what we want to encourage you guys to avoid is those problems. And, okay, we're probably all going to get a bit red from time to time. That just happens with time in the saddle, but it doesn't have to get that bad, and you can talk about it, and there are other options of saddles. It can be difficult because saddles are expensive, but... there are ways about it, and you know, my biggest recommendation is just ask other people if they've got spare saddles you can try them out, get a bike fit, something like that. What saddles have you used in the past, Tom?
Do you know what? Honestly, I think I've taken the wrong approach, because I've literally just Googled which one is the lightest and stuff like that, and just to this day, I've genuinely never considered what is the right shaped saddle for me. I've either stuck with the one that came with the bike, or I've gone, right, Sella Italia, make the lightest, so I'll get that one. You know, that's all I've done.
Well, it can be pretty hard to know where to start with saddles. There's just so many different types. But perhaps a good place to start would be getting one that's the right width for your bum. I had a chat with Garrett Getter from Specialized about saddle widths and how you go about hunting down that perfect saddle. I don't know whether or not Specialized were the first saddle manufacturer to bring out different width saddles, but it was certainly the first one where I noticed it as a consumer, that it was regularly possible to be able to purchase saddles in different widths. And the first saddle I bought was a Specialized, and I had this option of which saddle to buy. And to be honest, I didn't know what to do. So how would you recommend that a customer in the same position as me, you know, what processes do they need to go through, or what do they need to know in order to be able to find the best fitting saddle for them?
That is That is the question of all questions, I feel like, for saddle recommendation. And it's a very valid question. It's a question a lot of people ask. And for sure, you know, getting your sit bones measured first is a great starting point. You know, we definitely have a very, very high success rate of people that have, you know, measure their sit bones first, and then, you know, the shape comes second, of course. But, you know, that correlation between sit bone width and saddle width is just so important. So starting there, definitely the right way to go. From there, you know, it's really depends a lot on, you know, the retailer or who you're working with to determine, you know, the right saddle for you. And I'm sure you can relate to this, just by sitting on a saddle for a few minutes, you don't really know how it's going to, you know, how it's going to play with your soft tissue and anatomy. And so it's like, it's so important to be able to get out and actually ride the saddle, and to have a retailer or someone that's willing to, you know, work with you to try different saddles to find the right one for you. You know, for us here at Specialized, we're constantly trying to figure out how to better, you know, recommend or even prescribe a saddle to the customer so that, you know, some of that guessing work can be taken care of ahead of time. But, you know, when it really comes down to it, the best advice I can give someone is to seek out a retailer that has a lot of experience with fit, that has demo saddles that they're willing to lend out, and create a relationship with that retailer, and, you know, feel comfortable to tell them, yeah, there's something really uncomfortable in this area, and hopefully that retailer or that bike fitter has, you know, experience with that and can recommend a shape to try out in order to find the right shape and width for the rider.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you about what you're saying. I think that the problem is that saddle fitting isn't really an option in many bike shops, and it's difficult if you're going to buy lots of different saddles because it gets expensive. Mostly I recommend to people, you know, I get a lot of people asking me about saddles, and I say, you know, contact people in your local club, ask them if they've got any spare saddles, because everybody's been through this, or a lot of cyclists have been through this, and they will have spare saddles lying around, and they'll say, try this one, and so, you know, then you can do it without the costs. I don't think I know of any small or bigger bike shops near me that you can actually hire saddles out, which is a shame, and I really think that they're missing a trick. But in terms of measuring your sit bones, is that something you can do at home? I mean, how would one go about that? Do you get a tape measure and just measure across your bum?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a few ways you can do it. And I would suggest anyone that's listening that's interested in figuring out what their sit bone widths are to Google, you know, measuring your sit bones. And
I imagine there's some brilliant YouTube videos.
Yeah, there really are. And, you know, the ones that we personally have found to be the most effective is actually using like cardboard.
Ah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and there's some great videos on that, and we're working on ways to really help the riders that don't necessarily have the opportunity to visit a store to get measured to be able to do this at home. You know, the one thing that we do have that is pretty amazing is we do have a digital sit bone measuring device too, and that those are in most of our retailers. You know, that device not only will measure your sit bones, but it will ask you a few pointed questions to help determine, you know, what could be the right shape to start with. You know, those are a few different ways you can measure your sit bones and start to figure out what shape you really need.
So now we know a little bit more about how to get fitted for a saddle, and that actually saddle width is really incredibly important. But I also wanted to know,
how on earth do they go about actually designing a saddle in the first place? And what are the processes involved in designing a saddle?
You know, it really starts with, you know, trying to figure out where we're missing currently. And that's how, you know, within Specialized, right? I think we have a pretty good lineup of different saddle shapes, padding technologies, widths. And for us, it's just really seeing where potentially some riders are missing. And so that's usually the starting point. From there, we've actually started to utilize more 3D print technologies to actually prototype product, new potential saddles. For us, you know, the slowest point is cutting the actual tools that we use for a traditional foam saddle. Those can take months to make. So for us, any of the work we can do to be able to test some hypotheses and before, you know, spending a lot of money on tools is really where we, you know, where we get the most benefit. You know, once we feel like within our testing pool of riders that we've got a product that's pretty good, then we'll cut tools, then we'll expand the testing pool to more riders, get feedback, continue to tweak the shape, you know, obviously do a bunch of testing to make sure it's safe and lasts a long time. And then generally we bring the product to market. And, you know, within that as well, I would say there are a lot of additional steps, but at a very high level, you know, that's kind of the foundation of how we create product. You know, the one thing I would add as well is before we bring that product to market, you know, once we feel like within ride testing and, you know, within production, we've got a product that we can make, you know, we have a whole human performance team based here in Boulder, Colorado, that will actually utilize to, you know, validate the comfort and safety of the saddle, with subjects that are not associated with Specialized. You know, fortunately Boulder has a huge cycling scene, so we have a great pool of riders that we can bring in and do some validation to make sure that we're actually creating a product that is, you know, truly an improvement over something that we've already made and is, you know, offering all the soft tissue health benefits that our body geometry saddles have been known for years.
I'll tell you what we love on this show. We love things like graphene, futury things, so 3D printing really fits into that. And actually, we're going to do something on 3D printed parts for a future episode.
Well, funny you should say that, because Physique recently released a 3D printed version of their Antara saddle, shortly followed by Specialized releasing a 3D printed power saddle that they've called the Power Mirror. So I know from experience in the Peloton how popular their power saddle is. And having seen rave reviews for their 3D printed mirror power saddle, I wanted to find out exactly why this saddle suits so many riders and what was quite so special about the 3D printed version.
Well, for sure, you know, I think when everyone looks at the saddle, the first thing that's is obvious is how short it is. And so you definitely can't deny that the length of the saddle has some effects on it, but you know, it goes much further. I mean, when you're looking at the saddle, if you're to compare a power saddle to a normal traditional saddle, you know, it's really how the saddle transitions from the nose to the back of the tail of the saddle. You know, the power is very unique in how quickly, how abruptly it transitions. I'd say that's probably one of the most unique aspects of the power saddle is just how supportive it is right where your sit bones and your pubic rami really come in contact with the saddle.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the new Power Mirror, because I'm pretty excited about this, having seen... I don't actually ride the Specialized Power Saddle myself, but so many people I know ride it and so many people love it. And having seen the brand new 3D printed version, the Mirror, and actually having seen rave reviews for it already,
I'm quite excited to see how that kind of goes forward. But yeah, so I just wanted to ask you a bit about this. So what material do you use to actually print the mirror saddle? And how on earth do you manage to get the flexibility, build the flexibility into a 3D printed saddle? Because usually 3D printed items are really solid.
Yeah, so this is a really unique material that we're 3D printing with. It's an elastomeric polyurethane, and it's a material made specifically for a printer from a company called Carbon Incorporated. Carbon Inc. makes kind of a very, very unique 3D printer that utilizes actually infrared light to print a saddle or print any type of shape that we ask. And so the combination of the printer tech and the actual material we're printing with is what makes the lattice or the foam material, you could call it, the upper material, so unique for this application. And obviously, you know, it's also been super popular because of the shape that we went with, it being a power saddle. You know, the shape is tried and true. And, you know, so we decided to use that. And then in combination with the technology that Carbon has. And then finally, you know, just taking everything we've learned from the introduction of the power saddle, then the Mimic saddle, and kind of utilizing all of those learnings into one product.
So what was, are you allowed to tell us the exact kind of makeup of the what you used to 3D print it, or is that top secret?
Yeah, no, it's not a secret. It was an EPU 41 is the material that Carbon used, or that we used, and it's a product that has really, really good energy absorption and kind of energy rebound, and the combination of those two characteristics are what makes the saddle feel really comfortable, right? Like really soft when you sit into it, but also takes some of the road vibration out of the saddle. That's really what's super unique about that material.
Something that I think is quite interesting about that design is, so with a traditional saddle, you've got foam, or some kind of foam, and then, you know, after time, it does sag, or, you know, you might find you need to replace your saddle after a certain number of years, maybe, depending on how often you ride your bike. What's the longevity like with this saddle, or is that not tested yet? Because with this lattice structure, is there a risk of, you know, when you're sitting on it and come back up again, that compression, constant compression, is there a risk that it's going to crack, or that the lattice will break or snag?
Yeah, it's, you know, we have a lot of internal testing we do to kind of validate new technologies like this, but in some cases it's going to depend a lot on the riding conditions and all that. But what I can say for sure is, you know, the material itself is the same material that Adidas uses in their running shoes. So as an example, like, you know, it's used to have, it's, this material was tested with way bigger kind of, I guess, mechanical needs or physical property needs than what we would traditionally need it for. But then, yeah, it really does come down to ride testing and different environments. And fortunately, we do have a lot of, you know, high-end athletes that are riding the saddle. And yeah, to your point, the foam saddles over time do have some deformation, right? Like the foam does start to break down a bit. And not only that, but the shell also starts to lose a little bit of its shape characteristics. And that's just the result of, you know, putting some very high P pressures on very small areas. But, you know, in the testing that we've done with some of our pro athletes, you know, they actually found that this saddle seemed to feel like it maintained its riding characteristics longer than what they're used to with some of our normal foam saddles so far. But yeah, like I said, that will depend from rider to rider, different situation. But yeah, we tested this product to the same standards we would anything else, and we actually, you know, from what we've seen, it performs to the same, if not better than what our foam saddles are doing right now. Our job as product designers and managers is probably never finished unless we make the absolute perfect saddle. And I don't know if there's a good way to make a perfect saddle until you can really customize it to each rider, you know?
Well, we've talked about my gruesome saddle problems, and I'm still suffering from them. I think, you know, 6 months of indoor training, sitting probably on the tip of my saddle without any movement, hasn't done me any good whatsoever. But someone else who's had problems is someone you spoke to, Hannah Dines.
Yeah, so Hannah Dines is, she's an incredible athlete. She is such an inspiration for me. And she is an athlete who has competed at the highest level. She's competed at the Paralympic Games in Rio. And she really pushed through the pain to compete there, with one of the most uncomfortable injuries of all time. You know, having an injury in the saddle area and training every day is really, really tough. Finally, this situation got so bad with Hannah that she ended up reaching out for help and having surgery. But getting to that point wasn't easy. I spoke to Hannah all about her story.
Okay, yes, my name is Hannah Dines and I'm a paracyclist. I ride a trike, which is a three-wheeled upright bike, which looks a bit like a clown car, but if you made it into a bike. And I've been cycling internationally on the kind of elite level since 2015. And then I was taken to the Rio 2016 Games by the Great British Paracycling Team and was on squad with them for a couple of years. But then in 2017, a series of unfortunate events happened. My trike got torched by thieves and British Cycling said, no, you're not going to be on program anymore. But I've not given up on my goals because I came fifth at the Games and I'm currently fourth in the world. I'm so close to a bronze medal. I won a bronze medal in 2019 and I was hoping maybe I'd get back on squad and be able to go to the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games, but careful what you wish for and plan for. I'm now kind of in limbo land, trying to make everything work, still, you know, keep cycling and everything. I do another sport on the side, like I'm a two-sport athlete. I'm also a race runner with para-athletics. That's a side deal, but really I'm still cycling and still kind of training, and that's me.
Yeah. So, as a cyclist, you obviously spend a lot of time in the saddle, and it's no secret that you're a cyclist that's had some saddle issues, and I think every cyclist has probably had saddle issues. Some people like to talk about it, and some people don't, but, I mean, I've had saddle issues. I actually started my career by having a big old saddle issue and ending up in hospital, that didn't go very well, and it's taken me quite a long time to find the right saddle, and a lot of that has just been trial and error. What's been your experience with finding the right saddle, and where did you start, and then how did you go from there?
So some people don't like to share their story, and other people write their own article and get it published in The Guardian in a national newspaper before telling anyone else about the fact they had to have surgery for a massive, massive saddle sore. That was my story. So the problem really was that I got into cycling really late on, like I was 19 or whatever, and then I was kind of rushed to the Paralympics, so from zero to elite really very fast, and there wasn't much time there. So I literally got my mum's saddle. That was the first saddle I had, and that was the only saddle we had, and it was put on the bike. And if you ride specialized equipment, like adaptive equipment, like I do, you don't get like a bike from British Cycling or anything like that. So really we had to, you know, fund our own equipment. So we just used that. I just used that for, didn't change.
And what saddle was that? Do you know?
Yes. Oh, off the top of my head, I've kind of like, you know, it scarred my memory so
blanked
much.
Blanked it out. Yeah, I understand.
It was a Diva Cell Italia. And that was, you know, that was supposed to be, you know, cut out in the middle for women. But I'm not sure if they actually used real women to create it, or, I mean, not I think that every saddle is good for somebody, but it wasn't good for me, for sure. So, yeah, that was bad. And then I got really bad problems from the beginning, but I didn't have anyone to tell at all. There was no access there. And then I didn't also think it was something that I could tell anybody about, that it was, you know, another thing. You just say, shut up, legs, or shut up, vagina. Like, I am gonna do this. I'm gonna get to the Paralympics and take all the pain, you know, I can, because that's the strongest people, the toughest people that don't say that, you know, they're in pain. They get there, which is actually now I regret.
So you were struggling through this saddle problem whilst you were trying to get to the Paralympics and whilst you were riding in the Paralympics.
Yes.
Wow.
It's very competitive. I mean, you'll know yourself, but it's very competitive trying to make it onto a program. And I was on development squad, and then, you know, on academy, and then you're battling for places, and you're training every single day, you know, with all, like, you've got one day off, and that's not enough time to research saddles or anything. And I guess because it's a gradual issue, it's like a chronic condition for some people. Some people are fine, some people are not. And some people just get huge problems, and it doesn't appear right away. It's certainly mine. Anyway, there's a variety.
So how long were you suffering with problems with this particular saddle?
Oh, wow. So even after Rio, I didn't get, you know, I was always like, oh, I'll do it after the games, or I'll do it, you know, and then I got taken off squad, or I needed to make a power target, right? So I come back from Rio, and, you know, when everyone else is resting, you know, I have this target to make in January. So then I get back on the bike and I'm like, right, okay, let's go again. I can do this. So, you know, for three years, I didn't say anything about it. No.
And then presumably at that point, it really came to a head and came to the point where you just couldn't sit down anymore, I guess.
It was just massive. My problem was not external, like, infection or anything, not broken skin. It was an internal lump that grew, and essentially was like fatty tissue that tried to protect a bit of my perineum that was, like, in contact with the saddle in a bad way. And then it was so massive. It was just like a winter training season that my volume ramped up in 2017. It was so, to 2018, it was so bad. And I was like, right, actually, what am I doing? Like, I'm not on squad. I don't have, you know, I need to get this sorted before 2020. And so I did.
Yeah. So this is the bit where it gets a bit gory then. And so what actually happened next?
You can read about it, but I'll also tell you here, and it does make people squirm, but yeah, I asked Scottish Cycling, who supported me at the time, and they were amazing. I can't believe I didn't go and say, hey, I need to deal with this, but I had to get it, like, I had to get it cut out, I had to have all these scans, because initially if somebody presents with a lump, they're like, oh, that's cancer, and quite a few doctors thought it was cancer. And so that was really scary. I had to have two different surgeries. And it luckily worked out really well for me. And then, yeah, you get looks brand new, not very brand new actually, but better than it was. And I can now sit back on a saddle, which is miraculous. Thank God for
surgeries. I mean, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Once you, it's so difficult to reach out to somebody, but once you do, there are people out there. And so I think this is the main message that we want to get across to people, is that it's fine to have problems with saddles, and every single cyclist has problems with saddles, but people just don't talk about it. Men have very, very commonly have problems with numbness, and it's something that can cause big problems in the future. And nobody talks about it, but getting a saddle fit, or just experimenting with asking people, you know, if they've got a different saddle you can borrow, and finding the right saddle. Okay, sometimes it, you know, there maybe there's no other option than to operate, but that is an option. And I think that it can be a really scary thing to, well, firstly ask someone and say, you know, I've got a problem with my saddle area, because it is an intimate area. But it's really important to be able to understand that it's fine and it's normal and it does happen when you spend a lot of time in the saddle.
It's actually more embarrassing if it develops into a problem that you have to have like proper medical attention for. If you actually catch it early, when it's actually just a bit of redness, you know, that's actually less embarrassing than having to have all these gynecologists, you know, having to say the word vulva to loads of different doctors and men. And, oh, you know, I would say tell people to start with, and then, you know, and find a solution early. It's much better to say it early.
So, yeah. Well, firstly, I'm really glad to hear that once you had surgery, it's kind of sorted things out and, you know, things are new. but what did you do about your saddle at that point? Because clearly this old saddle wasn't working for you. And how did you go about trying to find the right saddle? Because I think that's something that's really, really difficult in itself. There's so many saddles out there. How the hell do you know which one's right for you?
Yeah, it was, I mean, I'd been doing loads of research to try and, but I couldn't afford any other saddles. So that was the big thing, right? Even before, like during this time when I was really sore, I was like, oh, well, I just changed the saddle, but I actually couldn't find a saddle that was good for me. Anyway, so I got the surgery and I had a lot of time off the bike and I'd written this article. And then when it went big, some saddle companies came to me. Now that was really important that they actually sent their products to me. And currently, and Specialized was the one that works for me. So they sent me their saddle, their Power Mimic, their Power Saddle, oh my goodness, Power Saddle with Mimic Technology. And that actually really did work. And then also ISM, Adamo Saddles, they sent theirs. And a few others that actually didn't work for me. I mean, basically, no one saddle fits all is the rule. So it's actually really hard. You really need a saddle library. I wish I had the time and energy to make one. That was one of my goals in life when I'm done with the Paralympic thing.
Yeah, I think that is the main message, is that everybody's body is different and everybody sits on the bike in a different way. And although there are some saddles that generally are better for some type of people, it's definitely not going to be something for everybody. And I know that for me, I have tried sitting on a kind of traditional, in inverted commas, saddle, and I use an Adamo PM 3.0, and mm-hmm. it's the only saddle that I can sit on. I simply cannot sit on a normal saddle with a nose. Yeah, it's different for everybody. And sometimes, you know, sometimes a lot of people reach out to me and say, you know, what do you recommend? And I'm like, well, you know, go to the people in your local cycling club, and people will have been through different saddles. Ask them what they've got. Try this one, try that one. But it's about just trying it for a bit. And it is difficult because often you can't go to a bike shop and just borrow a saddle. I wish there were saddle borrowing programs, but there aren't really. And like you said, I've been in the situation as well where you want a new saddle, but you simply can't afford one. So I had actually bought, in the past, I've actually bought an Adamo off the internet, and it was an old one, and, you know, one of the sides was drooping a little bit, and then so I ended up a bit lopsided, and it was only a bit later down the line that I actually was able to afford a proper Adamo saddle. And, you know, buying a secondhand saddle that had been used and been kind of, you know, made wonky by someone else caused its own problems. So it's a really, really challenging thing to get right. And unfortunately, it's an expensive thing to get right as well. But I think asking people who are kind of in the cycling circle or maybe in a local cycling club is a really good way to try and find, you know, a saddle that you can try. And it's just about trying things out and getting the right things for you, and not being content with being uncomfortable, I think, is the main thing.
Yeah. And also, I think I got a few bike fits as well, and they have, you can in a bike fit, they normally have a bunch of saddles to try, and that a bike fit can be really spendy, but it's actually probably as expensive as one saddle. But they could have like 8 saddles for you to try with pressure mapping. I have to say, if I could like recommend anything to spend your money on, bike fit first, because at least you'll be able to try out a bunch of saddles and maybe have feedback from like pressure sensing. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I used to do, Lizzie, and I kind of abandoned it, is I used to be quite religious about using chamois cream, and then I've kind of stopped using it at all. Sort of, maybe I've just put it down to something that's unnecessary and has no benefits.
I have to say, with chamois cream, I definitely go in waves.
we were sponsored by, I think, chamois butter when I was riding for UHC. And so because it was there, I kind of used it. But then when I was training, I didn't really need to. And then but then I was on a saddle that I didn't get along with. So then I did use it because it kind of relieved some of the difficulties. But actually, chamois cream isn't always the best thing to use. Actually, you want to use a kind of chamois cream. But a kind of more plain barrier cream is better. Anyway, I had a chat to Hannah about this, and we talked a little.
I'm very familiar with barrier cream, having a baby and a toddler all over it. I've got an endless supply, so that's great to hear.
Well, maybe that's what you need to start using, Tom, and that'll hopefully relieve your time off the bike. Talk to the doctor if you need to. Anyway, I had to chat to Hannah about saddle health, and in particular, chamois cream.
Yes, chamois cream. I love this. I use this phrase to describe why we need chamois cream. And it's because of slugs, right? You know, slugs, they would cut themselves up on concrete, but they slide everywhere on these crazy surfaces. And you know what stops them getting hurt is because they've got a massive bed of slime that they slime on. And that's the same, you know, chamois cream stops us getting horrible wounds from the saddles and the sharp. It's not necessarily sharp, but they're kind of, you know, the abrasive effect of a chamois pad. So for me, actually, like, branded chamois cream is not necessarily the best thing. Generally, you want, like, medical grade, medical grade, like, dermal, and I always forget the name, but basically stuff that you would use for eczema. Without any of the active, like, actual medicinal ingredients is really good, like at your local pharmacy. Although sometimes, you know, just for simplicity, I do have some chamois cream that I have on the side just in case I run out. And also sometimes it's cheaper, depends.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of chamois creams will actually have perfumes and things in them to make them smell nice. But I think there is a good bit of evidence to suggest that very plain moisturizers, things like Dermol 500, things like aqueous cream or E45, these are really the best things to use on your downstairs, and they are way cheaper as well. You know, you can get a big tub of aqueous cream for £2.50 or £3 from the pharmacy, and it's just so unobtrusive, it's so plain that it can't, you know, it can't cause any problems almost. So I think if you're struggling with trying to find the right thing to use or struggling with different chamois creams, then give that a go. And try and keep perfumed things away from your chamois area. And you can also use these products to shower with as well. You use them as an emollient and like a soap instead of a perfumed shower gel, which can really cause problems too. I don't know if you've had any experience with that in the past, Hannah.
No, I just know I've been taught from a very young age, like, you don't want to wash too hard. Like, basically, you've got your own pH inside all of your body. So, especially for women, you know, we've got a higher risk of getting UTIs. And if you try and use, like, really heavy chemicals down there, you know, you are going to disrupt that. And actually, that's, you know, you think you're being hygienic, but you're not. Actually, it disrupts the natural bacteria that fight off the bad bacteria. So just like you know, antibiotics, like, are terrible for your intestines, it's the same thing with putting perfumes or putting anything that's excessively antibiotic or antibacterial down there. You want as simple formulas as you can get, both with, like, chamois cream and or washing. Actually, the Team Pursuit girls were the best at let me know about Dermal 500 and all of those brilliant brands, like just normal basic pharmacy brands. You know, there's a guide for, like, moisturization after a ride, and also I think it was Emily Nelson who told me, and I've published this with Cycling Weekly, that her guide to doing it and to keeping, like, good chamois cream health, I guess, but, like, with non-chamois cream substances that are cheaper, as you said, like, I couldn't say better than you've put it there. So yeah.
Okay, Lizzie, well, listen, I am going to take better care of my saddle area. I'm going to layer on the barrier cream. I'm going to get a proper saddle. I've learnt my lesson, I think.
And I think the lesson is, if you have a problem, and especially if it's a chronic problem, do not be afraid to go to the doctor. You know, that's what they're there for. Especially with cycling, often you put up with these things for a long, long time. And once it becomes a chronic problem, I mean, it gets to the point where, you know, only certain interventions are actually going to kind of relieve the pain and relieve the pressure. So never be afraid to go to the doctor. It's a completely normal thing. If you sit on a saddle a lot, you're probably going to get saddle-related injuries. There are things that you can do to help, using kind of Dermol 500 to shower and using it as a chamois cream instead. But don't put up with a sore bum.
Well, Lizzie, like we said, next month we're hopefully doing an episode all about 3D printing and 3D printed parts. And there's some fascinating stuff in that. In the meantime, you'll be off to the Giro. We can watch you, I think, this year, can't we?
I think you can. I think the GCN Race Pass has the live coverage of most of the stages. I don't know how much, but actually there was a pretty decent amount of coverage last year. So I think it's really great because it's such an exciting race. And of course, with it falling alongside the Tour de France, perhaps it doesn't get the coverage. Well, it definitely doesn't get the coverage it deserves. And this year is going to be a brutal edition of the race. Basically, the organisers, you know, they just thought, oh, if there's a hill, just put it in. There's not an inch of flat in the whole 9 days of the race. So I think it's going to be a really interesting race. And because we're kind of down south, there's not the traditional long climbs that there have been in previous Giros. So I think it can make it a really dynamic and really open race. And I think that every day you're going to see fireworks and surprises. And I also think, because of the situation with COVID, I think that athletes are not all in the place that you might expect. And it's been more challenging for some. Some have overtrained, some have undertrained. And especially if people have overtrained, that's going to come back to bite them at different points. And I think you're going to see riders blowing up spectacularly at different points, and then some riders just surprising people. So it should be a great race. Please tune in, and I'll catch you at the end of the month.
Well, good luck, Lizzie, for the rest of the season, and I'll speak to you next month.
Thanks, I'm going to need it. I will see you at the end of the month.
This episode of Service Course was produced by me. Our theme music is Beyond the Black Veil by the brilliant Moscow Youth Cult. Do go and check them out. And the rest of the tracks in the show come via Epidemic Sound. For details of the individual tracks, then please check the show notes. Thanks again.